excuse me, 5313, by its terms, does not and cannot create a debt. This is so because the veteran is receiving benefits to which he is legally entitled, and that the operation of 5313 does not result in the veteran receiving benefits which he or she is not entitled to during a period of incarceration. Congress chose to limit the purpose of Section 5313 to the reduction of benefits by the Secretary. This requires no affirmative action by the veteran. It requires only that the Secretary act on the 61st day of incarceration.
How is the agency to know that it should act?
That they have their own computer connections with facilities that incarcerate felons, the same way they do with Social Security, so that they can cross-check the admission of a veteran to a correctional facility based upon a felony. This is a process that has been in place with the VA for at least a decade, if not longer, in which they are able to do that. And I believe that this court can reasonably infer that Congress thought that 60 days was a reasonable time for the VA to be able to accomplish that, because Congress wrote that the reduction shall not take place until the 61st day. If the notion was it was to start from the day of incarceration, then there would be potentially a delay in making that determination. But the way in which Congress wrote this statute, Congress clearly said that the Secretary would not act to reduce until the 61st day.
It also says that there won't be a reduction until that time. So anyone who's incarcerated for 60 days or less will not have a reduction at all. So
that's correct. Yes. Or if they're simply not incarcerated. You can get a conviction of a felony and not be incarcerated and get probation or some other form of non-incarceration supervision without being incarcerated. The point of this statute is that once a veteran who is receiving benefits has been incarcerated, then their benefits must be reduced by the Secretary. The entire burden is on the Secretary. There is no burden placed upon the veteran.
The problem I'm having with your interpretation is it just says shall not be paid. Doesn't talk about putting the burden on one party or the other. And so I'm struggling with that.
Well, with due respect, Your Honor, the only person mentioned in the statute is the Secretary. It says the Secretary shall reduce.
It also says any person who's entitled to a compensation but is, put in a penal institution should not be paid. So that's another person who's mentioned.
But that is the, if you will, triggering event for the Secretary to act to reduce. The role of the veteran is not affirmative, but merely passive in the sense that the veteran, if you will, meets the qualification for the statute to have his or her benefits reduced.
What year was the statute first? Did the statute first provide for this kind of reduction in benefits?
I believe it was 1980, Your Honor.
So if it's only in the last 10 years that the Secretary has developed some sort of computerized connection to make this determination, doesn't it seem unlikely that that's what Congress was counting on for this to happen, and why it contemplated, I think you attributed the 60-day period to the time it takes to figure this out when you're not told, whereas it could, seems to me, at least as naturally, maybe even more naturally, be understood to mean really short interruptions. We're not going to ding the veteran.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I have no idea when they had got that computer access. I just know that they have that computer access. But the point being that the way in which the statute is written, it gave the Secretary, as early as 1980, 60 days to determine that. And obviously, that this court can make a reasonable inference from that delay that that was the time frame that set the Congress thought was a reasonable time frame in order to obtain that information. Now, I grant you there are a number of things that are missing from this statute that Congress could have written, but they didn't. And one of those things is how does this information get conveyed?
Well, Mr. Carpenter, as I understand your theory, it is that the payment can be reduced during the incarceration, but once the incarceration is over, as is the case in this instance, that the secretary can't go back and recover the money that was improperly paid.
That is correct.
What would you say if, for example, the secretary discovered after 3 months or 4 months that the individual was incarcerated? Under those circumstances, since that would be during the incarceration, could the secretary get the money back for the first 2 months, or does the first, once the first check is cut, is that gone forever?
I think the statute can reasonably be read to allow the secretary to act any time during the period of incarceration. I don't think there's anything magical about the 61st day.
And the action would take the form of a recovery of the debt later, for example. I mean, suppose that the amount paid, let's take this case. Suppose that it was the very last month, and the secretary discovers, oops, I've been paying way too much money. And the secretary says, okay, I've discovered that there is a problem here. We have to get the money back. Could the secretary then initiate debt recovery proceedings?
I'm not sure that there is anything in the plain language of the statute that gives any clarity to that. With the notion of when they can act, I think they can act any time during. The ambiguity is, are they able to act retroactively within the period that the Congress granted authority?
Mm-hmm.
In this case, we're only talking about a retroactive action after the statutory grant of authority had expired.
Now, as I understand it, if there's an overpayment, suppose I'm a veteran and 1 month the VA just cuts a check for $100,000. I'm entitled to $10,000, but they slip a digit and they send me a check for $100,000. They can come back, and if they can't recover the money in some other way, they simply reduce my payments in the next multiple months, right? Isn't that the way they recover overpayments? That's the way it's done everywhere else in the government.
Well, Your Honor, because of the special nature of this system, there is a general counsel's opinion that I believe is cited in both parties' briefs, mm-hmm. that specifically says that a administrative error by the government shall not be subject to an overpayment so long as the veteran didn't do anything to contribute to that.
In other words, the veteran under my hypothetical would be able to keep the $100,000?
Honestly, I've never had that fact set come up. The fact set that I have come up against is a slight variant of that hypothetical in which an award of past due benefits was made twice. In other words, there was a partial grant and an award of past due benefits made, and then a second award of past due benefits made several years later, and they duplicately paid the full term rather than just the succeeding term.
And the veteran was
And in that case, the veteran was not held liable by the VA because it was an administrative error by the secretary.
What is the statutory provision that says that if there's an administrative error by the secretary, the veteran can retain the payment?
It's cited in the brief. It's cited in the brief, Your Honor. Excuse me. And I don't believe it's a statute. I believe it's a regulation.
The waiver is certainly available to the agency in appropriate cases.
Yes, yes. And that's what we're talking about here is waiver.
Oh, okay. But that's true across the government. that waiver is always available if it be a hardship or so forth. But absent the agencies deciding that waiver was appropriate in a particular case, then presumably under my hypothetical, they'd be able to get the $100,000 back by just reducing the payments over a course of years.
Yeah, and another point about your hypothetical, Your Honor, is that if the agency recognizes that error quickly, then the agency is perfectly capable of retrieving that money.
Unless
back.
It's been spent on an expensive car or something.
Well, no, actually, if it's deposited, and most benefits are now directly deposited, then the bank is on the hook, because the VA can take that deposit out, and I've had that occasion, but that circumstance happen.
Right.
I see that I'm into my rebuttal time. I'd like to reserve the back.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Kerlin.
Time with a mask off indoors in a long time. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. The flaw in appellant's interpretation of the statute here is that they continually read language into the statute that simply isn't there. In particular, appellant over and over and over again claims that the statute includes a time limitation that says that VA can only limit payments during the incarceration. A good example of that is page 1 of the reply brief, where appellant uses the word during multiple times. The problem is that word and no words to that effect actually appear in the statute. Section 5313 contains a general prohibition on paying a veteran disability benefits for a period of incarceration. It says the veteran shall not be paid, not during, but for the period of incarceration that is after 61 days. That's the plain language of the statute. It's a general prohibition. It contains no time limitation language, nor do any of the other myriad debt collection and offset statutes that one could point to from the mechanics of how this works. That is only further backed up by, I would say, both common sense and the legislative history. We can go to either one first. The legislative history is clear and has been continually recognized both by this court and the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. One example is Mulder. Another example is the Snyder case that both parties have cited in their briefing. But it's fairly well.
Of course, the Snyder case, I guess, has a footnote in which they said we're not addressing the particular question that is presented to us. As I read the footnote, that appeared to be what it's directed to.
Yes, and to be clear, we don't think that the Snyder case is particularly applicable in terms of controlling this case.
Right.
It's been mostly cited by the other side. We don't see anything in the Snyder case that helps them.
Okay.
But we're not citing it as, you know, it answers this question. But I guess it is pertinent, and it does, to a certain degree, make very clear that what was animating Congress was a non-duplicative payment of benefits to veterans while they're incarcerated. If the state, the legislative history indicates that if the state is otherwise maintaining the veteran, Congress did not want taxpayer money spent on disability benefits, the partial intention, which is also to maintain the veteran. Very clear about that.
It doesn't fully answer the question, does it, that of what the secretary is entitled to do once belatedly the secretary discovers that the money should not have been paid.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I think it does answer the question, because that duplicativeness issue does not change whether the secretary finds out that the veteran is incarcerated during the incarceration or after the incarceration. And as we've indicated in our briefs, really, one does not even need to go to the legislative history, because if one were to read the statute in the way that appellant does, you end up with an absurd result. We use the word moral hazard in our brief, but another way to look at it is an absurd result, where any veteran that complies with their duty to inform VA where they are in prison would have their benefits reduced, but a veteran who either knowingly or unknowingly fails to inform VA that he or she is incarcerated then would get to keep their benefits.
Is there any other situation that you're aware of in which an overpayment cannot be recovered if it is not discovered promptly?
No.
The example that comes to mind is if a veteran has a certain level of disability and the payments are according to that level, and that level is administratively reduced, and that the payments should have been reduced accordingly, and they're not. The VA continues to pay at the higher level. Presumably, is there any reason that the VA could not, even years later, go back and recover that money in one way or another?
No, not that I'm aware of. The relevant statute
of limitations, I suppose.
There's no statute, and as we pointed out in our brief, there are several debt collection and overpayment statutes and regulations, both generally applicable to the United States.
There are no statute of limitations.
None of them contain a statute of limitations. Mm-hmm. Except there's one exception that has no applicability here, which is if there's a 6-year statute of limitations on the United States seeking a money judgment rather than so that if we were going to come and try to collect a judgment.
But offsets would not be covered
offsets,
by the statute
right.
of limitations.
So that's 2514A is money judgment, not applicable here. Section 2415I, which we've cited in our brief, clearly accepts. Offsets.
So this would be the only situation that you're aware of in the VA or, for that matter, anywhere in the government in which an overpayment cannot be recovered if it isn't determined during the pendency of the incarceration?
As far as I know, yes. Right. And I would be remiss if I didn't give you the two statutory sections for offsets, which are 31 U.S.C. 3716 is the general one, and then VA's section is 38 U.S.C. 5314, the next section after this one, both provide for offset. No statute of limitations limited, however, there is a limiting principle, which is the offset provision, VA's offset provision 5314, is limited by the ability to seek a waiver, in the name of equity and justice. Mm-hmm. That's 5302, but it's specifically referenced in the offset provision 5314. And so that's the limiting principle. If something really out of left field were to happen, you can always apply for a waiver, and presumably one would have a strong case for getting a waiver. There is one other issue I wanted to address that came up during the appellant's remarks, which is we would respectfully disagree that there's no duty on the veteran. There's a well-recognized duty upon veterans set forth in the now somewhat long-standing precedent from Heisen v. Brown. It's known as the Heisen duty. It's referred to that way in CABC decisions. We cited it in our briefs. I believe page 15 of our brief, we talk about Heisen. A veteran has a duty to notify VA where they can be contacted, but it's not really that limited. It's really, their duty is to notify the veteran, the VA of their situation.
What are the enforcement mechanisms for that duty?
There's no enforcement mechanism for that duty beyond the fact that if you don't tell VA, for example, that you're in jail, and they find out after the fact, they may come and retroactively seek to reduce the benefits because they shouldn't have been paid at that time. I don't know that there's any punishment, but for example, in the Davis decision that we cited at page 15 of the brief, it was a situation where I believe the veteran claimed that he could not get correspondence from VA in jail, but it, for whatever reason, it was clear that he was still able to contact VA, and the court said in that case that the Heisen duty still stands, and it was his responsibility to inform VA that he was in jail.
I suppose that plays some role in the question of failure of notice, which is maybe what you just described. That is, violation of the duty to inform VA may actually be a significant response to what would otherwise be a claim of "I never got notice."
Right.
Is that right?
That's right. Well, I think as you started your question, I see that's not where it ended up. I was hearing there was a failure of notice to VA. I mean, there may be other cases, but in this case, it's pretty clear that VA had no reason to know that Mr. Gurley was in prison He was not in prison for a particularly long period of time, but long enough to satisfy the statutory requirements to have his benefits reduced. VA employed their computer matching system. That computer matching system, by the way, we have a footnote on this, does not somehow destroy the Heisen duty, right? I mean, just because, and your honors are correct that the statute has been in effect since 1980, and I don't know for a fact, but it's hard for me to believe that VA had a computer matching system in 1980. But in other words, they employed their computer matching system. They found out just a few days after he was released, but it's really his duty, and it is generally understood to be the veteran's duty in this jurisprudence to inform VA where they are, including if they're incarcerated. And in this case, there is no indication that VA was given any kind of notice, but ultimately was able to find out and then took appropriate action. So it seems
in your view that wouldn't make any difference. Would it make a difference if the VA had been told on day one that he was incarcerated, and just because of a bureaucratic failure, they didn't stop his checks? Your position wouldn't be different, would it?
That's not the case before the court. I'm not sure that our position would be any different, but I think this is an easier case than that, because this is a clear case where no one told VA.
All right.
Can I
just double check? The waiver, the denial of waiver was not appealed. Was it appealable?
Yes.
Okay.
So from other cases, other than this one, I recall there may be some limitations on that type of appeal, but I believe it was appealable. And in particular, I recall that the board and potentially the Veterans Court as well in this case indicated that they weren't deciding the waiver issue because Mr. Gurley had not appealed that issue.
Well, in other agency cases involving overpayments, we've certainly addressed waiver denials. That has not infrequently a litigated issue. So one way or another, that issue has come to the court.
Right. My waiver denial case settled before we got before Your Honor. So I don't
know whether that's true of VA, but I have certainly seen it in the context of overpayments for Social Security and the like.
I deduce from the fact that the board took time to reference the fact that he had not appealed the waiver issue, that it was appealable.
If I'm understanding this right, at Appendix 94, the November denial of waiver says basically you have appeal rights.
So my sense is that it was appealable, but it is not an issue I focused deeply on in this case because it was not an issue. But I don't have any reason to disagree with that. If Your Honors don't have any further questions, we respectfully request that this court affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims.
Thank you.
Mr. Carpenter, you have a bit over 4 minutes.
I'd like to begin with the expansion of the duty noted by the Veterans Court in Heisen. The duty in Heisen refers only to the duty to inform the VA of the veteran's address. It's so that notices and benefits can be sent to the correct address. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the obligation to notify or to somehow expand that. It is not vested in any statute or any regulation. It is something that was judicially created by the Veterans Court, which this court is clearly not bound by, and clearly, in my view, would be grossly inappropriate to expand that duty when there is no statutory basis that ties directly to the matter at issue here. And the matter at issue here is whether or not an overpayment was created. And Judge Bryson, going to your questions to the government relative to the waiver of overpayment, that presupposes an overpayment. The position, Mr.
Right.
Gurley, is there is no overpayment
right.
in this case.
Right.
There couldn't be an overpayment in this case, and therefore the question of waiver is simply not relevant as a matter of law. The only way an overpayment gets created, and the government did correctly note that it appears in the very next section of the statute at 5314. And what it says is that the secretary may deduct the amount of indebtedness of any person who has been determined to be indebted to the United States by virtue of such person's participation in a benefits program administered by the secretary. The secretary is not administering any benefits program when he is following the mandate of Congress in 5313 to reduce benefits.
Well, now, you're not, well, I guess you are. In your brief, you suggest that the payment of benefits to Mr. Gurley, setting aside the payment of benefits during the period of incarceration, but the general payment of benefits to Mr. Gurley for his condition, was not a benefit program. Do I misunderstand the argument you were making in the brief?
It's slightly more nuanced than that,
okay.
Your Honor. The point is that, yes, participation in the receipt of compensation is participation in a VA benefit program.
Okay. All right.
What is not participation is what takes place under 5313, because the benefits aren't being changed. They're merely being reduced. There is no change in his right to the benefit that is received prior to entry to incarceration. And in fact, the statute contemplates that that benefit will be reinstated upon release. It is merely within the window. And let's look at...
But suppose you had a situation, as I was asking government counsel about, in which the level of disability had been reduced from X to Y, and the payments, therefore, should have been reduced, but they weren't. Wouldn't that continue, those continued payments, be part of participation in a benefits program and subject, therefore, to recovery?
No, because the veteran is not required to take any affirmative act. The language of the...
So in my case, setting aside the incarceration issue, if the veteran is getting much more money than he should be getting according to the level of disability he's been accorded, he's not participating in a benefits program when he's receiving that money, and therefore it can't be recovered?
In that scenario, yes, because that's an ongoing payment. That's what the statute refers to as a continuing payment, a continuing obligation to pay.
Mm-hmm.
If the secretary has made a mistake in what that amount is, then the veteran may be liable for that if it can be shown that the veteran knew or should have known that he or she was receiving the larger amount of payment. But that's not the circumstance here. And what is critical to understand, the government claims that the word during isn't used in the statute. Well, the words that are used by Congress is for the period beginning on the 61st day of such incarceration and ending on the day that such incarceration ends. That's during. There's no other way to interpret that phrase. That is a defined window. Begins on the 61st day, ends on the day of release. That is the only period of time that is covered here, and it requires specific action by the VA and no action on the part of the veteran. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. The case is submitted.